London calling. David here. Something a bit different today. This one's about a book I've been reading. And about London. And about an epiphany. They all connect up. One at a time. Epiphany first. It's a great word. It's of course got almost primal religious significance. Christian religious significance. The Feast of Epiphany. It's the 12th day of Christmas, the 6th of January. It's the story of the infant Jesus and the three wise men from the East, the Magi. The three kings who come to Bethlehem to see and pay homage to the infant Jesus. Come with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. It is, of course, an extraordinary moment. A moment of realization, arguably second to none. A flash of insight. Though a close contender would be that moment 33 years later, when Jesus' peeps turn up and the stone has been rolled away, the tomb is empty. But the one at the beginning of Jesus' life, the one the word epiphany signposts, is of course that God is a human being. In fact, a newborn child who is the son of a humble Jewish carpenter and his wife, and into the bargain, the Son of God. As realizations go, well, what a moment. It's rewarding to shine a bit of light on the word itself, epiphany. It's Greek. You break it apart, you get that little prefix, E-P-I, epi. It's the same prefix you get in the word epidermis, or yes, epidemic, means on, upon, above, to. So epidemic is on the demos, or people. Epidermis is on the flesh, our skin, in other words. And epiphany? Well, the main root of the word is phainein, to show or shine. That child was God, that shone through, was suddenly there, had arisen, had come through, was visible from the surface of things, on things. 1900 years later, that idea of a moment of intense realization, of illumination, of truth suddenly shining through, there to be seen and grasped. It becomes an artistic principle for the great Irish novelist James Joyce. In Clay, a short story in his collection Dubliners, there's a rather sad little woman named Maria. She's a spinster. People feel sorry for her, but also mock her a little bit. To put it bluntly, they're glad they're not her. Her life is pretty threadbare, barren really. An acquaintance, doing his good turn, invites her to come to his house and join his family for a Halloween dinner and a bit of festivity. They play a blindfold game. The blindfolded person reaches into a container for little prizes put in it. Maria's hand goes in, and it goes into a little pot of wet, clammy mud, clay. It's an awkward moment. People laugh uneasily, and it happens to her. It's an epiphany moment. It's the suddenness and the coldness and the clamminess, the awfulness, really, of her hand going into that clay. It releases something, the barrenness of her life, what a sad little affair it's been, is borne in upon her. It's her epiphany, her moment of intense, profound realization about her life. It's not adding up to very much, how impoverished it is. It's a sad story. Anyway, that's our word. Now, as for the reading, I'm about 30% of the way through Hugh Thomas's magisterial The Slave Trade, his 800-page history of the Atlantic slave trade. It's the most harrowing, the most appalling book I've read this century. Something, several somethings on every page that are from a terra incognita, a world almost incomprehensible, a terrible place. Several somethings on every page that don't just appall. If only I should be so lucky. No, reading it is a long, terrible journey across continents and across centuries, across a Holocaust on an almost unimaginable scale. Evil, evil, profoundly evil stuff. Yes, almost beyond comprehension. And that terra incognita, it's a terra incognita that's both out there, real places in history, but also terra incognita in another place, in the minds of the men and women who were doing what they did to their fellow human beings. Reset, reset, reset. By that I mean, it's a book that keeps changing the way I see the world. Monoliths that I took readings by and felt favorably disposed to, now, at the very least, seen in a different light, even toppled over. The Renaissance, for example, something that we're all taught from the time we're about 12 years old to look up to and admire, its praises sung again and again. Well, think again. Here's what Hugh Thomas says about it. The Renaissance in Europe had no humanitarian pretensions. Its hard, gem-like flame reburnished the ideas and practices of antiquity, the institution of slavery among them. It was entirely logical that the discovery of the New World should be attended by a rebirth of the idea of forced labor. A Flemish diplomat, Ogier Gislain de Busbecq, en route for the Constantinople in the mid-16th century, even regretted the shortage of slaves in his day. "We can never achieve the magnificence of the works of antiquity," he sighed. "And the reason is that we lack the necessary hands, that is, slaves." And so we come to London. The first 200 pages of the book are pretty much confined to the Portuguese and the Spanish. They were the main players in the early days of the slave trade, the Atlantic slave trade. But now, 200 pages in, we're getting home. We're in Northern Europe, and especially here, England, London. Now, they took to it all right. As appalling as the Spanish and Portuguese were, they were almost amateurs compared to what our forebears were capable of once they saddled up and hit the slave trail. And the epiphany? Well, let's stop by page 199. Let's drop in at Westminster. I'm not sure we know the exact location. Could be Westminster Hall, maybe Whitehall Palace. But we do know the date and the occasion and who was there and what was afoot. It was September 20th, 1672. The occasion was the chartering of the Royal African Company, and signing off on it, His Majesty himself, King Charles II. That charter read as follows. "We hereby, for us, our heirs and successors, grant unto the same Royal African Company of England, that it shall, and may be lawful to set sail such as many ships, pinnaces, and barks as shall be thought fitting for the buying, selling, bartering, and exchanging of, for or with any gold, silver, negroes, slaves, goods, wares, and manufactures. Witness the King at Westminster, the 7th and 20th day of September. The charter gave the Royal Africa Company a 1,000-year monopoly, 40 generations. They were thinking big. Its run was actually 61 years, the lifetime, give or take a few years, of one slave. That it could have been 60 lifetimes almost doesn't bear thinking about. But who were they, these adventurers in this exciting new business opportunity? The king's brother, the unemployed Duke of York, future James II, was president of the Royal African Company. The king's sister had a share, as did the Duke of Buckingham. We've been talking about him for years on every London walk in the Embankment area. Knew absolutely nothing about his panting to get in on some slave trade action. Well, I know now. Same goes for Henry Jermyn. Jermyn Street is named after him, and it figures in a lot of walks. And the Duke of Albemarle. There's another London street name, better known as General Monk, a hugely important player in the restoration of the monarchy. And Lord Sandwich, the admiral who brought Charles II back from exile. And Lord Craven. Oh, we've all sung the praises of Lord Craven, that brave philanthropist who didn't run away during the plague, stayed in London, helped to maintain order, donated property for burial grounds. A praiseworthy figure. Well, a praiseworthy figure who, topping up his personal fortune with soaring profits from the slave trade, seemed like a good idea to him. It gets worse. John Locke. John Locke, the philosopher, the apostle of liberty. Yep, he was at it as well. As was, maybe the biggest shock of all, Samuel Pepys, every London Walks Guide's favorite Restoration character, with the possible exception of Nell Gwynn. Favorite because of his wonderful diary and his honesty about himself and his out-of-control penis and his wide-eyed observations about his fellow Londoners and their city. How the mighty have fallen. Yes, Samuel Pepys wanted in on, got in on, that slave trading action. It stained everything. And now I as a guide, have to take this new virgin biographical territory into account. Reckon with it. It's never ending. It gets everywhere. It's cancer out of control, slavery. Even my great love, literature, is tarnished. Think Robinson Crusoe. I maybe just about remembered that he was enslaved for 2 years, and yes, escaped, but had no recollection at all that he escaped to become a would-be slave trader in Brazil. So one book, admittedly a big book that's packing for this kid a whole lot of epiphanies. Going to close this with an observation about Rembrandt. He was a superb draftsman, even when he was a very young artist. He could paint portraits that looked exactly like their subjects. That skill never left him. But along the way, he picked up another skill. He learned how to paint epiphanies, how to paint character into those faces. Take the big step beyond the skilled draftsman stuff, bone structure and skin and eyes and lips and the rest of it. That probably came about because he ripened as an artist and a man. He learned some things about his sitters, about people, about life, about himself. That's all.